Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU, LPFM, Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. My name is Chuck, and I'm with you, as I am every Friday, from noon to two, bringing you a Bluegrass Bios, a show featuring people doing extraordinary things with a unique connection to the bluegrass, and with us in the studio is certainly one of those people. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Shannon Stewart-Smith.
Great. And hey, how's it going, Shannon?
It's going very well, Chuck. Thanks for asking me.
Excellent. Well, first of all, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Sure.
You know, I appreciate it. And I think one thing I really strive to do on the show is highlight people who've done a lot of good work behind the scenes in Kentucky and maybe sometimes don't get a lot of the spotlight, but really are making things happen here in our city and things for the good. So first of all, I guess the first question I want to ask you, or I want to let people have a little bit of background information about you. You know, you're a lawyer, mm-hmm. a nonprofit consultant, a board member of Lexington Community Radio. So thank you for your service to the station. Also the founder and former executive director of the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition,
mm-hmm.
and the former executive director of the Plannery,
mm-hmm.
correct? And many other things, but we'll get into all those a little bit later on. So first of all, Shannon, where are you from?
Well, I get that asked a lot, but I can't say that I'm any from one place. My father was in the military, so I grew up all over the United States.
Right.
I was born in Tucson, Arizona, but I was only there a couple of months after my birth and have traveled all over the United States and overseas, and actually did a couple of years in the Philippine Islands while my father was stationed there, and traveled Southeast Asia, got to see Hong Kong and Tokyo and Japan a little bit while I was there. And then after I left home, I joined the racetrack, thoroughbred racetrack circuit, and moved around some more. But since 1986, I've been here in Lexington, Kentucky.
That's great. And so where did you end up going to school? Did you go to college?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I was actually working here in Lexington in the resource business on the thoroughbred farms, and decided that I actually wanted a law degree, but I hadn't gone to college yet. Mm. So I said, okay, well, I have to go to college. And my family had settled in Southern California, so I joined them there and went to UCLA for my undergraduate studies.
Oh, that's great.
With the intent of returning here to go to the University of Kentucky Law School.
Nice. Well, what did you end up studying at UCLA?
I have a degree, an associate degree in philosophy and a bachelor's in philosophy.
Nice. So important to, you know, get the real groundwork done.
Yeah. I chose that. It turns out the logic component of that dovetailed nicely with the law school.
I believe it, yeah. So where did you end up going to law school?
Here at UK.
At UK?
Uh-huh.
Great. So how was there any difference in the transition from living in California to coming back to Lexington? Besides
well,
the seasons?
Yeah, no, it's mostly the traffic. That's what I was glad to give up. But I had been living here in Kentucky, and I left some of my furniture and belongings here with the intent of returning. So I went out there for college, came back here. So it was more like a shock to go out there than it was to return. So,
that makes sense. So Shannon, I know most people in town know you from your nonprofit work,
mm-hmm.
or you know, even with your work with the Climbers Coalition. But I know you mentioned to me that you worked in the horse industry here in Lexington for a
mm-hmm.
long time. So can you tell us a little bit about kind of how you got involved with that and what you've done?
Yeah, right out of high school, I'd always been interested in horses ever since I was wee little, and had looked for some employment with horses. And at the time, when I was in high school, I thought the only thing opportunity would be a veterinarian. And then it turned out my father was stationed in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. Well, actually, Bellevue at SAC headquarters, just south of Omaha. And there's a racetrack, or was a racetrack in town in Omaha called Exarvin, which is actually Nebraska spelled backwards. I'd never thought of the racetrack. I'd never seen a race. I'd never seen a thoroughbred, actually. And my next-door neighbor got a security job there, and he said, hey, there's all kinds of jobs at the racetrack. And I said, that's great. I can work with horses all the time. So I one Sunday morning, after I got my chores done at the job I had at the stable where I kept my horse, I went over to the racetrack, and I knew exactly which barn I wanted to go to, so I walked in under the shed row, and first person I saw asked me if I wanted a job, and I said, sure. And it just took off from there, and so I walked tots, which is the beginning job for all people on the racetrack. In 1 week, I was a groom, and 3 months, I was an exercise rider and shed row foreman, assistant trainer, and eventually got my jocks license and rode in the Midwest for a few years, and so traveled all over. Then came here to Lexington and worked both at Keeneland, Churchill, and a lot of the larger farms. Always had a passion for riding horses, so I got into breaking the young, well-bred yearlings on the farms, mm-hmm. and then I would gallop the horses on the racetrack after that.
Yeah, that's the hard work, is breaking in those young horses.
They're pretty, it's
true.
Yeah, I enjoy it a lot, because when you're working with these really nice, well-bred young horses, they do it really well and take their time with them. So
I imagine it's a little bit like mountain climbing, though, sometimes, if they start bucking.
Well, actually, I transitioned from riding into rock climbing, and it was a nice transition, because people used to say, oh, rock climbing, that's really dangerous. And I said, oh, no.
Yeah, the rocks
That rock climbing is very safe compared to those riding those horses.
Yeah, the rock is static, yes. You know, it doesn't have a mind of its own.
Yes.
Without a doubt.
And one of the few jobs I know of where they keep an ambulance sitting right there at your workplace.
Wow, that's true.
So there was always an ambulance at every racetrack I've ever worked at, and in the afternoon at some of the better racetracks, they actually have the ambulance follow the jockeys around the racetrack during the race.
Interesting, just in case.
Just in case. That's how dangerous it is, yeah.
So you mentioned that you have your jockey's license. Mm-hmm. So what is involved in getting a jockey license?
Well, you have to make weight for whichever breed of horse you want to ride. In my case, I rode thoroughbreds, quarter horses, and Arabians. Mm-hmm. And for thoroughbreds, to get your license, you have to be approved by a steward who watches you break out of the starting gate. You'll break a couple times, and they will verify that you know something what you're doing, and you have to have a trainer vouch for you. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to get the apprentice weight allowance, because you're inexperienced, they will allow trainers to take 10 points or 10 pounds off of their mount in a race if you ride a really inexperienced rider up to a certain number of wins. And it's usually, at some point you lose what's called a bug. And so in your apprentice year, you're called a bug rider. Mm-hmm. And the bug came from the term, they would put an asterisk by your name to indicate that you're inexperienced or an apprentice rider. Mm-hmm. And the asterisk looked like a bug, so that's how you got the name. And so that's for a period of time, usually about a year, sometimes two, you're as an inducement to trainers to ride you, trainer gets a weight allowance off of their horse. So they have an advantage to make up for the disadvantage of having an inexperienced jockey. But really, the requirements are your weight. Learn how to gallop horses and then work them in the morning. And then after you acquire your jockey's license by passing what is, I guess you would view it as a practical test.
Like a road test.
Yes, like a road test from one of the stewards that's qualified.
Do you have to parallel park the horses?
No, you just have to make sure you don't fall off when they come out of the gate. And shockingly, coming out of the starting gate is a much harder task than one might think.
I believe it.
It's like being shot out of a cannon.
Yeah.
And so that's how you get your jockey's license. And then quarter horses is not, once you have a thoroughbred license, that license is from the State Racing Commission, so it carries over to other breeds as well.
Mm.
After that, now getting your trainer's license is a multiple test. It's both written and oral and practical, and I mean, it varies from state to state. But
That was going to be my next question is, do you have to, so if you ride in New York, do you have to have a New York jockey's license?
Yes, you do. Each state has its own state racing commission that has its own requirements, and some states are far more stringent or have greater requirements for their state. And two of the higher states, of course, would be New York and California, and Florida would fit in there behind that as well.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Well, so you mentioned that while you were working in the horse industry, you got an interest in pursuing law in some degree in the horse industry. What were you wanting to do?
Well, at the time, it dawned on me that race horse owners in the race industry was driven a lot by, believe it or not, the tax code, and until the tax code was dramatically changed during the Reagan years. Mm-hmm. And so it actually, decisions to own or buy or how many horses to keep or in one stable up for an owner was really more of a tax shelter decision than more of just a love of horses. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea when I had been working on what they call the backside of the racetrack.
Yeah.
And when I got on the business side, I was like, what? Is this tax-driven? Really?
Yeah.
And so I had in my role, job I had on one of the thoroughbred farms, came in contact with the tax attorney for some of our owners. And I became, somewhat familiar with the fact that, hey, that sounded like a pretty nice job. I was interested in it. So that's how I got interested in acquiring my law degree. And I thought I would use it both as a business degree and then also perhaps, I even thought about using it to help people who lived and worked on the backside in their whatever capacity I could to improve their life. When I went to law school, I sort of took a different path and got interested in doing a little bit of trial work. I even interned briefly with the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office here in town, Ray Larson, before he retired. And then when I got out of law school, I went right back to working on the racetrack. And I wasn't really as interested in using the law degree in a business degree, but stayed with the horses for a little bit longer and then discovered rock climbing. And actually, I would gallop horses in the morning and then go climbing in the afternoon.
Nice. That sounds like a sweet day.
Yep. And so I transitioned from one into the other.
Only if only you could gallop them to the mountain, right, and climb. So what kind of caused that transition from the more business acumen side to more nonprofit, more community-driven work?
Yeah, well, I started to lose my sort of interest in the, not in horses, of course, but in the business industry side of science, and became more so, I'd say, consciously aware, and social justice became more of a priority for me. And so when I was in the climbing, early in my climbing career, I became aware that climbing was practiced or enjoyed on national forest land, and the National Forest Service actually was considering how they were going to manage climbing, even to the degree that they might close it. Mm-hmm. And so at that opportunity, I just, because I was one of the few climbers, not the only climber, but one of the few climbers in the area that had a law degree, I took an interest in looking at the federal laws that would have applied, and volunteered to sort of meet with the Forest Service and start negotiating some way that we could keep climbing open on the Forest Service. So as a result of that sort of introduction to a new sport that I had just, you know, become very passionate about, I decided I could use my law degree that way, and that seemed a better fit for what I was interested in.
Certainly, and I don't think a lot of people realize just how endangered Red River Gorge was for a long period of time, and not just for climbing, but also, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers wanted to flood the whole thing.
Oh, that's correct.
Right, which, what a travesty that would have been.
That would have been, yes. In fact, the Corps of Engineers, who were the ones that were tasked with building the dam, they still own the actual plot of property that was going to be the side of the dam, that still sits there. But yes, there's the famous story of William Old Douglas that was invited to come and walk what is now affectionately referred to as the Douglas Trail, as one of many strategies to bring public awareness to the possibility of it being flooded.
And, definitely, yeah. You know, if you show people something and make them fall in love with it, it makes it hard for them not to fight for it.
Yes.
You know. Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition.
Sure.
So how did the organization get started? What gave you the idea to were you meeting other hikers around that were climbing, or, you know, just climbers? Or
well, we had a national, we still have a national climbing, nonprofit climbing organization that represents climbers to what we call land managers, and they could be state park or local land managers or the federal government. I could be the Park Service, the Forest Service, or it could be BLM managers. But they were working at a national level. So when I became involved with the Forest Service trying to manage climbing in the red, and they were somewhat taken aback by the fact that there were these people who had self-appointed them, you know, just had taken upon themselves to start developing climbing. Mm-hmm. It seemed pretty clear that this was just a people problem of sort of managing expectations. Yeah. And so, but the climbers, there was no point person or no organized way for the Forest Service to really communicate or interact with the climbers. So we got the idea of starting a nonprofit, the Climbers Coalition, to organize ourselves in order to actually have a group that the Forest Service could start talking to, and we could sign a memorandum of agreement with. And cool. And the only other recreational group to this point that has stepped forward as an organized group were cavers, it turned out. And the Forest Service actually looked for these types of groups, recreational groups. It turns out hikers, not so much. There was no other organized recreational group. Now, there was the Sierra Club and some environmental groups, but no recreational group other than the cavers that were really organized. So climbers came together, and in 1996 we started the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition, and because of that effort, the Forest Service and the coalition was able to work through a lengthy process to come to an agreement on how to manage rock climbing and keep it open.
That's awesome. And so, Shannon, can you give us an idea of who are the climbers out of Red Sure. River Gorge? Where are they coming from? Are they just from Eastern Kentucky? Are they from Lexington, Cincinnati?
That's a great question. The Forest Service wanted to know the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we volunteered to run a survey of climber users, and we did it both by looking at the license plates of the cars that were parked in the known parking, climbing parking areas, and then walking up to the crag and actually interviewing climbers and finding out where they were from, what states they were from, how long they were planning on staying, and how much money they spent in the area, because this was sort of an economic impact study,
sure.
along with understanding who our users were. Then we were able, as climbers, to identify the actual routes and the level of difficulty that were being used, and we were able to find that there was a greater need or a greater activity at the lower or moderate grades, and then at some of the more classic higher grades, which indicated to us that our group user group fell into two main groups, but a much disproportionately large group were what we would call recreational climbers, and our largest users were coming from Ohio and to the north of us, because it turns out the four or five states to the north of us are have the least amount of rock or climbing resource. The states to the east and south of us, Tennessee and West Virginia, have enough rock resource that their citizens didn't need to come here as often unless they came here for the high quality stuff that they were seeking. So it turned out for every one Kentucky climber we saw, we would see anywhere from 5 to 10 Ohio people.
Wow.
Michigan or Indiana or Illinois. So they're really our largest user group. And the Forest Service made us aware that if you do a 500-mile radius around the Red River Gorge, it would take in nearly 66% of the entire U.S. population in the East Coast.
Wow.
And so we are within a driving distance to a large chunk of America. So we get a lot of people, and the Red River Gorge is considered an international climbing destination.
Yeah.
So in addition to our locals, we also have a lot of international users as well.
I believe it, yeah. And I knew a lot of people in Japan that knew about the gorge.
Exactly.
Just because they just came here just to climb it.
That's exactly
Maybe drink
right.
some bourbon and head home. So, yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And, you know, it's interesting to me going to places like Arches National Park in Utah where, you know, the structures are very similar to what we have here. But I think it's the accessibility that really makes Red River Gorge a special place, because Arches, you can drive right up to the Arches or maybe hike a mile and, you know, get to see everything. But with the gorge, it takes a little work to get to see some of the treasures out there. So
it does. The cliff line's hidden back behind the hardwood forest, the deciduous forest we have. And the infrastructure is something that the climbers themselves, that's part of why we ran into a conflict with the Forest Service, was they were quite taken aback when they realized how much infrastructure climbers had industriously, you know, already had in place, much to their surprise. We had our own designated parking areas and trails that we had, user-defined trails that the Forest Service calls it, and we had put together a very extensive and comprehensive guidebook that was being sold, and so, yes, we were good to go.
Yeah.
We didn't need anybody's help. We'd built our own little paradise of climbing, and the Forest Service didn't even really had caught on how popular it was. It wasn't that they didn't know, they just didn't realize how vast and extensive and well-known the climbing was here. And then climbing slowly moved away from the National Forest land exclusively, and then started to filter further south. And there's actually climbing runs north to south almost 20 miles from over five counties.
Wow.
And so it starts in the northern part up in the gorge, which is technically a national or a geologic area, and then all the way down to Lee County, where the coalition owns property in Lee County.
Wow. And so how often do you go climbing yourself?
Personally, I go 3 to 4 times a week, every week, throughout the year.
That's great. And what are some trails that are some of your favorites out in the gorge?
Well, those be on the Forest Service side,
In the Daniel Boone?
Yeah, on the Daniel Boone, and in the geologic area. Our trails are not so much marked and named like their trails are. So our trails are just access trails to get to the climbing areas. So.
Gotcha.
But I love the gorge, and I go there when we're not climbing, primarily during the winter months, and then when there's snow on the ground, I'll go hike there a lot in the geologic area.
And I've understand that And I understood that you blazed some of the trails yourself, or have created a few.
The climbs.
I guess I mean the climbing trails, but that's vertical trails.
That's okay. That's what the Forest Service considers routes. They consider them vertical trails. That's actually.
I see. Yeah. So is route the proper term?
Route or climbs, yes. I see. And our climbing here at the Red River Gorge is what's called single pitch. Mm-hmm. Lots of other places further west where they have taller structures. Everybody's familiar with Yosemite. They have multi-pitch, mm-hmm. but we have single pitch. And a pitch is a designation of how much a climber can do it with a single rope strand. So mm-hmm. a rope runs about 150 to 200 feet. Mm-hmm. So if you're, so routes are approximately 50 to 100 feet here at the Red River Gorge, and that's considered a pitch. Mm. And so those are called routes or climbs, either words used interchangeably. And every route, believe it or not, has a name, very much like a racehorse, and a grade of difficulty assigned to it. And it's recorded and kept, and then eventually will be cataloged in a guide that will give specific directions to where to park, where the trailhead is to get to a climbing area, and the climbing areas are named by the climbers. And then each climb will have a name and a grade, so you'll know how difficult, and it'll also go so far as to tell you how if it's a sport climb, how many bolts and how many anchors, or what the anchor configuration is, and a little bit about the route, if it's overhanging or if it's vertical or slab, what we call slab. And yes, and so your question was about that. I've put up some, and so there are. The Red River Gorge is known as a sport climbing mecca. Mm-hmm. Sport climbing are pre-placed bolts for safety that we drill a hole, half-inch hole in the rock, and place a permanent expansion, mechanical expansion bolt, or a glue in, so that climbers can come later and they will attach a what we call a quick draw that actually has two carabiners with a piece of nylon in between that they use as their safety system as they ascend the rock. And it's only employed if they were to fall. It arrests their fall from hitting the ground. So the pre-placed safety bolts are there simply as a, you can think of it, we like to tell the Forest Service, it's like having a really long safety belt or a seat belt. So if you fall or if you have a crash, you won't get that harmed.
Yeah, that'll catch you.
Right. And then there's only a handful, and when I mean handful, I mean 6 to 12 people active at any one time that's responsible for putting those bolts up.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask next. Are they engineers or just volunteers?
They're experienced climbers
who
usually live in the area. They give away all their labor and all the material, and per route, it'll cost out-of-pocket for that individual to donate that route $100.
Wow. That's amazing. And so do they have to free climb when they're drilling those in? Or
We're blessed here at the Red River Gorge. We can walk or find our way to the top, and we lower down from the top, and we install them on the way down.
I see.
And place them as we descend. And then once they're in place, then you can climb it from the ground up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. So like once you create a new route, how do you get the word out that it's there?
We have a really well-maintained website here for the Red River Gorge. It's called redriverclimbing.com for those who would like to check it out. We submit the routes that we call it bolting. So if we've bolted a route, in fact, I just did a description of two routes that we bolted in last week, myself and my partner. And so we will submit the description of the route to that website, and they keep a full online guide available to anybody for free. And we will also submit our routes to the next guidebook author. We'll come to know who it is, and then we'll submit that information to the guidebook author. And as the guidebook is updated every sometimes 3 to 5 years, those will be collected and entered and will be added to the next edition.
That's great. And so in addition to kind of maintaining trail, or sorry, not trails, and maintaining routes, but maybe the trails to get to the routes, what other work does the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition do?
The Coalition originally was working with the Forest Service when climbing was exclusively on Forest Service land and on to a lesser degree on some private land. And then in 2003, I received a phone call from a gentleman who was from New York. His name was John Myers, and he called me up one day. I was sitting at my desk in my bedroom that doubled as the coalition's headquarters. And he introduced himself, and he asked for the Access Fund, which is the national organization's regional representative, which I wore that hat as well, and I said, I identify myself as that person, and he said, I want to volunteer my services to the national organization, to the Access Fund, to see if you all be interested in buying land for climbing. I, in my professional life, buy land for hiking clubs up wow. here in New York State.
Wow.
But I'm also a climber, and it occurred to me that climbers could buy land to climb on to ensure its, you know, access.
Yeah.
And I said, that's a fabulous idea. And this was a really radical change. Nobody had really thought about buying large quantities of land and as a way to ensure access.
So kind of like a functional land trust.
It was going to go directly to a, it was not a land trust.
Yeah.
So these were just going to be worker bees that were going to take over and own it and manage it as private individuals, as private citizens.
Wow.
This was just really dedicated recreationalists. Mm. This would be like buying miles of trails or part of a river or
yeah.
buying whatever it is your infrastructure, your substrate is that you need to get access to.
Mm.
This was a really radical concept that nobody had really thought about.
Wow.
And I said, well, the national organization wouldn't, but the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition would be very interested in something like that because a lot of our climbing was on private land,
mm.
and we recognized that was going to be the future because the national forest land was compelled to follow federal laws, which were understandably restrictive in some way that they would allow usage for endangered species mm. or archaeological sites. So we understood that. It's one of the reasons why we worked so closely with them to make sure we were in compliance with those
yeah.
federal laws. But on private land, we found that there was just as much, if not more, extensive climbing available.
Mm.
But we were never never had secured access. And so with the opportunity to purchase it, we got the idea that if we owned it, they can't close it.
Yeah.
And
right.
that became our motto. So we set about looking for some suitable land to purchase, and we made our first purchase and recorded the deed in January of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
We bought our first 700 acres
wow.
in Lee County of some of the most prime climbing real estate there was.
Wow.
We've since made two more purchases and now own 1,200 acres and are the single largest landowner of climbing land in the world.
Oh, wow. In the world?
In the world.
That's
There's
incredible.
No other organization that comes close other than federal or state governments that own as much climbing land as the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition.
Wow, so the nonprofit owns that much land.
Yes, it does.
That's incredible. Well, that's fascinating.
Yes.
And
so then all through volunteers, no paid staff.
Mm-hmm.
We have just recently they started having a part-time executive director. All volunteers maintain all the trails, all
mm-hmm.
the trailheads. Volunteers put up all the routes. Parking areas, everything, and then we work with if we're still working with the Forest Service, we work with them closely to make sure our trails are up to standards and to reduce and mitigate impacts from climbing use. And then, yes, we set about to create the best, and, you know, we try not to alter the natural environment too much. We try to leave it as in its natural state.
Mm-hmm.
In the area in Lee County that we purchased our land, oil extraction had occurred in the early 1900s, and so we bought that property without the oil mineral rights,
mm-hmm.
but we have the timber and water rights with it. And so oil extraction is part of the only thing actually that's going on in this land. There are no residents, there's no other businesses,
mm-hmm.
and we are now, it turns out, neighbors with the Forest Service down there in Lee County.
Hmm.
Our property and their property are side by side.
Oh, nice.
And we continue to work with them on whenever things that they need help with.
Yeah.
For example, off-trail ATVs will sometimes pass from our property, which they're not supposed to go on our property, but they're allowed to drive on the county road that
mm.
will pass between our two properties. And we will try to work with the Forest Service in making sure that there's no damage or no off-road usage, you know, things like that.
So. Yeah, that's good. Good neighbor to have.
Yes. And
borrow some sugar.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, let's take a little break.
Sure.
Just in case people are joining us, we're here in the studio with Shannon Stewart-Smith, co-founder of the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition. And nonetheless, we'll be back in a bit. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. And we're back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. My name is Chuck, and I'm here with you until 2 p.m., and we're here in the studio with Shannon Stewart-Smith. We're talking about climbing, Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition, among many other things. So I wanted to ask you, for anybody who's out there listening who might be interested in climbing, you know, how would they even start? How would they get started?
That's a great question. We get asked it all the time. Mm-hmm. Climbing is one of those activities that is you usually get the urge to take it up, and you say, okay, so how do I climb? Mm-hmm. And we have recently been blessed with a new climbing gym in town, and I'll give a shout-out to La Escalade is mm-hmm. a world-class climbing gym. That's one way, and they have a great staff and a really great facility there.
So right around the block.
Right around the block, side. Yep. And UK's got a climbing wall. They mm-hmm. have a very friendly staff there. Those are indoor climbing places that you can learn the basics, how to tie into a rope and harness and shoes and stuff like that. There are guiding services available that will mm-hmm. take you out to get you on real rock, to sort of introduce you to what it's like on real rock. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, climbing is just one of those things you have to find somebody to just hang out with and go with. It's there is no professional or that just has not developed a business around teaching people how to climb
like
on their own.
Like an apprenticeship.
Like an apprenticeship. Yeah. 20, 30, 50 years ago, climbing was what was now called traditional climbing, is what a lot of people are familiar with, where we would climb cracks. Mm-hmm. And there was pre-placed protection in the form of spring-loaded camping devices or nuts or bolts or other pieces that we'd place in a crack that we would snap a rope to that would act like a safety system. Mm-hmm. And now that you had to, you know, finagle your way to get to apprentice
yeah.
with an experienced climber. And those are the people that will either do multi-pitch or mountaineering. Mm-hmm. And that traditionally that was thought to take a year-long apprenticeship to mm-hmm. master that mm-hmm. type of climbing. And then with the advent of sport climbing, which is derisively referred to as snapping, clipping bolts, mm-hmm. yeah. That's a little quicker. It doesn't take quite as long. And but there is no real easy transition from indoor to outdoor mm-hmm. other than trying to find somebody who is competent and experienced and to sort of develop a relationship with them, and they can introduce you to the sport. Mm-hmm. There are, UK had an outing club. That's I know some people come to it through that way. You can hire somebody, but that can get a little pricey. Mm-hmm. I myself paid for professional instruction at the New River Gorge. They have a guiding service there. I went out one day for fun, and then I came back a month later for a two-day traditional climbing, how to place all those little pieces in the rock
yeah.
so that I wouldn't hurt myself if I fell off. And then that was it. Then I started to read and just study up on my own, go out and practice. Mm-hmm. Other people have found friends, and so it's really very still. You have to find creative ways.
Yeah.
And there is no certified. I mean, there are certified guys, but I know several businesses have tried to take people out, but it's just not a cost-effective way, it
yeah.
turns out.
And that makes sense. And so where do free climbers kind of come into this? Because they seem like a renegade climbing crew.
They're a small you know? Portion, but a very, I mean, clearly they garner a lot of headlines yeah. and a lot of attention. Yeah, free climbing is not usually practiced in any area mm-hmm. that there's a chance or a high probability of rock breaking. And our Red River Gorge rock is pretty solid, mm-hmm. but still not solid enough like granite.
Yeah, and sandstone, right?
Yes, so. Ours is sandstone, all the Corbin sandstone, Corbin sandstone. So you'll see the free climbers in Yosemite on granite. Mm-hmm. That rock usually is considered more stable and reliable, and that is a very rare, small portion of people who actually climb, and that takes many, many years to be proficient and expert enough to pursue that part of it, and that's, like I said, a very small part. So we don't have, I don't know of anybody practicing free climbers here in the Red River Gorge.
Yeah, well, that's probably for the best.
Yes, definitely for the best. We discourage it for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It's high risk.
Oh, yeah, and being that far out, it's going to take a while for the Wolf County EMS to get
that's
to
That's correct, and we have enough of our own just user error, pilot error mistakes already without adding that into the mix, but yeah.
I believe it. Yeah. So Shannon, what are kind of optimal climbing weather or circumstances?
We have a season.
There are seasons. So when can people, if they're interested in getting out in the gorge, when would be the best time for them to do
it? We have two seasons, spring and fall, mm-hmm. and October is considered the prime climbing month, and in fact, we call it Rocktober.
Oh, nice. So perfect timing.
Yeah. And but I don't encourage people to just go buy rope and shoes and start climbing. Yeah. Really try to find somebody that you can determine that they're competent to go with them and work with them and practice. Now, I'm not advertising to do this on radio, but I do take a lot of people out climbing. In fact, I just offered my services to a person the other day, and what we do is there are people among us who enjoy introducing people to the sport, and we will help get them started.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of person you want, somebody who's really climbed a while and knows what they're doing. A lot of mistakes can occur, and I've known lots of people that said they could climb, took people out, and you know.
Yeah.
So try to make sure you're with somebody that you can trust. And we also climb in the spring. Winter and summer are not prime climbing times here at the Red, summer being too hot. Humidity is an issue, and human perspiration is an issue. So low cool temps and low humidity are the best times. Spring, March starts our season in the spring. It goes through March, April, May. Tapers off the end of May, June, July, and August.
Too hot,
down to a trickle. Then it picks back up in September, October, November. Then most people stop climbing during the winter, but you can climb year-round. I certainly have climbed every month of the year out there, and we've had some really fabulous winters, but that's mostly for locals. So climbing is usually divided into what are considered locals, which are people who live in the area and come here anytime during the week, like myself. Road trippers, people who come here for extensive road trips to stay and live and camp in the area for months at a time. And then we have weekend warriors, people that just come on the weekend and our parking lots will be full on good weekends.
Yeah.
And they're those people that drive down from Chicago or Ohio or whatever.
Yeah.
So those are the three prime, or the two prime seasons that we climb here at the Red. Our humidity is always something we're fighting.
I was going to say, do you carry maybe like a satchel of chalk with you or something to dry out your hands?
We do. Gymnast chalk was introduced by the famous John Gill back in the 60s. He was a gymnast himself, and he was a boulder, and he found that gymnast chalk became useful, and so now it's an essential part of our equipment that we all carry, what we call a chalk bag around our waist. And we some people have what's called a really bad chalk habit. I've climbed with people who perspire so much that it didn't matter how much chalk they used.
Yeah, that's funny. So that makes sense. And what happens if you're out there climbing and you're halfway up, you know, the side of a ridge, and you know, it starts pouring down raining? Is there a procedure and do you get down immediately? Or?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Red River Gorge is that why it's so famous and so highly sought is due to geology. Our rock, our sandstone, erodes faster at the base than at the top. The older rock actually erodes back away, creating what we call overhanging rock. So a good portion of the climbs at the Red River Gorge are heavily pocketed, which means they're featured for humans to be able to have handholds and footholds, but they're also overhanging, which is the more difficult type of climbing, but it's also protected from rain.
Yeah, interesting.
So we have a lot of climbs, I'd say at least half, if not more, if you can climb past above a certain level. If you're above a moderate beginner, you'll be able to have climbing in the most inclement weather because it's completely protected overhanging. It's like an enormous canopy of rock over your head that protects you during the torrential downpour.
So you're just kind of hanging out waiting for the storm to pass?
No, you just keep climbing.
Just keep climbing.
It doesn't come down and bother you until it starts raining for days, and then eventually we'll come over the cliff line and actually run down the cliff face. But rain, it usually is not a problem. We climb out in the rain. Now, there could be a lot of humidity that will make it less than ideal conditions. But that's for the more advanced climbers. For beginners, if you watch check the weather all the time, that's your best friend. In fact, my homepage on my computer is set to the Red River Gorge weather.
Nice.
So I'm always checking the weather. So, yeah, so you look ahead for a chance of rain. Yeah. And if you were caught in a rain storm, you would have to get to the anchors and then lower down and clean all your gear to get out of there. You're going to get a little wet if you get caught in the rain.
Yeah.
There's no retreat. You have to go back to the top to get down.
That makes sense. Yes. Wow. So, you know, I think we could, I mean, we could talk about climbing for a long time, but, you know, in our last 15 minutes, I really want to talk about all of the other work that you do beyond just climbing.
Sure.
I know that you were a member of the Kentucky Conference for Community and Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to people what that is?
KCCJ mm-hmm. Was a local bluegrass chapter of NCCJ, which mm-hmm. is still around, the National Conference for Community and Justice, which actually was started in 1929, was known as the National Conference for Christians and Jews,
mm-hmm.
which was established as a response to the rise of anti-Semitism mm-hmm. in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So NCCJ was formed as a way of fighting, beating back the, you know, it's funny what goes around comes around. We're going through our own version of that now. I mean, I see this stuff and it's like, yep, historically, this is just another cycle we're going through. But yes, it was a particularly virulent strain that was cropping up in Indiana, of all places, mm-hmm. and NCCJ was a response, national response to that. KCCJ came out of that as a bluegrass chapter that operated, and believe it or not, their history started because there was still segregation at University of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bluegrass chapter was established, and it went out on its own and became its own nonprofit in the 70s. They became their own nonprofit when the National pulled back and said, we are cutting back. We have to, for financial reasons, are determining that we have to cut back on certain chapters.
Mm.
So KCCJ was formed, and by this time the name had been changed to Community for National Kentucky Conference for Community and Justice. And it was located at 112 North Upper Street for a long time, right mm-hmm. across from the courthouse, and did fabulous work. Many people remember KCCJ doing Camp Anytown and many other racial training for the police department, mm. and they were involved with a lot of really great social justice causes. Then they went through their own reorganization in 2007, and that's when I got involved with them as a nonprofit consultant. And what they were looking for to do is sort of transition themselves into making themselves relevant to a wider audience beyond their social justice work, but what else could they do to help in a sort of a broad array of services provide to other nonprofits that are doing good work. And so we came across the idea of a multi-tenant nonprofit center,
mm-hmm.
and we visited one that we thought was an ideal candidate to that we could use as a sort of a prototype for what we want to do here in Lexington, up in Canada, Toronto, Canada, and brought the idea back and started what we call the Plantry,
mm-hmm.
which became our local multi-tent nonprofit center for nonprofits, which is located
And right next to Wessex Brewery.
At the second floor of Wessex Brewery, right exactly. upstairs. Yes, it kind of is over Smithtown and the brewery. And so it is lots of small nonprofits, sort of an incubator
mm-hmm.
for nonprofits. And so I helped with that transition and establishment and was the first executive director of that. And then now it's flourishing. And,
it is.
And it's just a wonderful facility for any small social entrepreneur. You can be a single social entrepreneur. You can be a for-profit. You can be it can be a larger nonprofit. But this is where nonprofits of all size, from a single individual to multi-staff, can rent space or use the facilities and come together, and it can be peer-to-peer counseling, and you can learn a lot from other people that are also starting their nonprofits or running them. Also, you get the advantage of having a mailing address. You have your printing there available, phone services, and kitchen, and then they have conference rooms and everything else.
Yeah, so. It's pretty amazing. And we've had Angela Baldridge on the show.
Excellent.
So we've talked all about the good work, so you can check out that old episode
if you
want to learn more about the Plantry. And, that's pretty fascinating. So that's where the idea of the Plantry came from?
Yes, that's exactly where the idea came from.
Not just a love of catfish and locally crafted beer?
No, not at all. No, we were looking for a way to actually help as many nonprofits that were doing good work mm-hmm. as possible. It's like a rising tide floats all boats, and mm-hmm. so we realized that by helping, it's kind of a leverage effect. Mm-hmm. You can if you can help multiple nonprofits, then you get more good work done.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole idea. And multi-tenant nonprofits were actually started in San Francisco, were rent space, or the cost for renting, was so high it was pricing nonprofits out of the market. So they established the first multi-tenant nonprofit center there, and then the idea, now there are over hundreds nationwide in both Canada and America, all over.
Wow. And I remember from our conversation with Angela that it's fascinating having the multi-tenants next to each other, because
yes.
their missions overlap so much that sometimes they physically overlap.
Yes.
And they do projects together, you know.
That's great. Yeah, this is one of the things that with my work, when I transitioned from starting the coalition and starting that, running that, and then I started helping other climbers start their own nonprofits, this is how I got into nonprofit work.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got involved with the KCCJ, I brought with them the idea that there's so many nonprofits that are in silos,
mm-hmm.
that don't know what other people are doing,
yeah.
and that they could benefit from actually physically being in the same proximity of other people with similar ideas, mm-hmm. doing similar work,
mm-hmm.
and sharing expenses, not the least of which would be rent, printing, telephone,
yeah.
and stuff like that. So it was just a natural outgrowth of what we already saw was going on. And so, yeah.
Well, it's an amazing product. And I know you also helped get Just Fund Kentucky.
Yes.
Or you worked with them,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Can you maybe tell people who don't know what Just Fund Kentucky is? And
love to. Just Fund Kentucky started by the co-founders Ernesto Scorsoni and Deborah Hensley.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough to be asked to join them with that, but they were the prime movers behind that. Ernesto and Deborah realized in all their nonprofit work, working for ending discrimination against LGBTQ individuals in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
that there are good nonprofits and individuals working hard to end discrimination, but always the same issue, raising money.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you know, we've got to do something about this all fundraising, this endless fundraising, because we're tapping ourselves out. You know, people are just basically trying to reach in the same pocket over and over. So they decided that they were going to spearhead the efforts to build an endowment, $1 million endowment, to get it established, and then we could add to it over time, so that at some point the endowment would be so large that we could start funding almost, you know, as many programs and activities and projects around the state to help end discrimination mm-hmm. against LGBTQ individuals. And so they talked to a well-known philanthropist, Cliff Todd,
mm-hmm.
and he was gracious enough to agree that if Just Fund were able to raise $500,000 in 5 years, that he would match that.
Wow.
And we would have our $1 million endowment. And that's what we did.
Some good motivation.
Yes. And so Deborah and Ernesto, with their leadership and all their connections, we raised our $500,000, and Cliff Todd matched it, good to his promise. And we now have $1 million-plus endowment at the Bluegrass Community Foundation.
That's amazing. And, you know, Lexington Community Radio as well has been a recipient of,
that's right.
you know, the money off of that endowment
off
as
that
Just Fund Kentucky's grants.
Yes, the Cliff Todd Endowment,
mm-hmm.
as it is known now, in honor of Cliff Todd, who's still very much alive.
Yeah.
This is not...
just honored.
Yes, just to his honor. We started out giving out tens of thousands of dollars, and now we give well over $40,000 and hope to continue that every year. That's what we give out as awarded in grants to well-deserving nonprofits like LCR and others. And yes, we are always looking for great ideas, and we have a grant cycle, and you can go to our website and read all about it,
mm-hmm.
and apply for a grant from Just Fund Kentucky.
Yeah, that's great. And so, gosh, well, there's so much to talk about. But the last thing I want to talk to you about is the Life Adventure Center.
Yes.
I know you work with them a lot.
Oh, yes.
And
I was going to say, I got to talk about Life Adventure
Center. Yeah, I think that's, you know, such a, I don't know, I don't want to say unappreciated, maybe an unknown gem.
Oh, my gosh.
Here close by.
Have you visited or no?
I haven't yet. No, I have so many friends who've been out there. I've been there, but I've never, like, climbed and done any activities around there. So.
Yes, Life Adventure Center, very near and dear to my heart. 500 acres in Woodford County,
mm-hmm.
Just south of Versailles. It is a fabulous nonprofit that its mission is to help particularly underserved youth to transform lives through self-reliance. We use wilderness experience, equine. These are programs that young people and adults can come out and be challenged personally and then learn. We use experiential education as a way to then turn that personal experience into a learning opportunity about yourself that will transform your life forever. Mm-hmm. So we've had inner city youth from Louisville. We've had women who have been victims of the sex traffic industry. Mm-hmm. We've had military vets that have come back from war with PTSD, and we've had a wide variety of people who have really benefited from a day, or in some cases a three-day course. We have a high ropes course, we have a wilderness experience, and we have an equine program, and the staff is well trained and experienced in being able to guide people through whichever program that may be appropriate for them, and then to really gain and grow from that experience in a deep, meaningful way that stays with them, to take a physical challenge and then to learn how they were able to overcome something that they didn't think they could do, like the famous high ropes course, jumping off, climbing to the top of the pole, off and ringing the bell, or some other really scary event, standing up on a horse, perhaps, something like that. And then using that information about yourself and overcoming that challenge, and then taking that with you to now know that you have the certainty that you could do that, and now you can face these other life challenges that you have. Wow. So.
Well, that's incredible work. And, you know, I've always read that, you know, something crazy like 30 seconds in the forest will immediately cause your blood pressure to drop. I guess unless you're running, but or climbing,
yes,
free form climbing. But you know, I think just being present in nature allows you to get away from all the things in our modern life that, you know, cloud our thoughts or get in the way from us, you know, really having a clear stream of consciousness and thinking, and working through those things.
Absolutely.
So yeah,
more and more evidence, studies, work all the time proving how our natural habitat is probably nature, our natural habitat, and that we benefit from that. But yeah, I just can't say enough great things about Life Adventures, and I feel so blessed to have been able to be associated with these fabulous nonprofits. And I've learned so much from them, and all I try to do is then take the behind the scenes at the board level, which is, to some people's mind, the boring side, and then help just take that, which is really applicable to a lot of nonprofits, and then help boards just be better at what they do. And that's help provide the governance and leadership for these wonderful nonprofits. They're the staff, or you cannot do anything without staff. Staff are the lifeblood of any nonprofit. They are the people they're interfacing with the people that they're serving. The board, on the other hand, are behind the scenes, but they too need their own support system. Mm-hmm. And so my starting and running and then getting other nonprofits up and running led me to understand that boards, you know, it's kind of a mystery. What do you do when you're on a board? Mm-hmm. You know, how do boards function? Turns out there's quite a bit. There's quite a bit of legality. You know, you have to comply with Kentucky law about corporate law, and then you also have to comply with the IRS. And so there's a lot of technicality and a lot of legal technicality that goes on that small nonprofits, not the big nonprofits, but the small nonprofits can't afford. And so here's this little small nonprofit's got a fabulous idea. They can't afford thousands of dollars in legal fees. And so that's why I was really moved to just say, hey, I think I can help you out. I think I know a few things that can, you know, that we can, I can show you, and you can continue to do your great work and not let being a nonprofit get in the way of the work they're trying to do.
Wow, like a climbing apprentice.
There you go. That's a great way to put it.
It's amazing.
It's sort of like being a nonprofit mentor, yes.
You are, yeah, and climbing mountains that sometimes seem impossible.
Thank you.
Without a doubt. Well, I think, without a doubt, Shannon, I think your work has left an indelible mark on our state, you know, whether it be through the plannery or the, you know, the climbing routes on the gorge. I think you've left a tremendous mark. Well, for the positive here.
I appreciate that.
So thank you for everything you've done for the state and for Kentucky and for our station here at Lexington Community Radio.
It's been a real honor. I've just enjoyed every minute of it, meeting all these wonderful people like yourself, Chuck, you know, working with this radio station. I mean, who knew? Here we are.
It's true.
It's just all the lives you can touch with all these fabulous people. That's the thing about nonprofits that I always want to tell people is these are passionate people doing wonderful things. And we just need to get all the resources we can to them to let them get the work done they need to do to help our community. And that, I mean, that's what drives me. I'm just very excited to do it.
It's true. Well, up and up every day.
Yes.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.
You bet.
Just in case you're joining us, we've been talking with Shannon Stewart Smith, co-founder of the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition. Also, many other things, co-founder of The Plannery, legal advisor to nonprofits all around town, including so many other things, but I'll leave them off. You should listen to the rest of the interview if you're just joining us. But nonetheless, well, thank you again, Shannon. We appreciate you coming
in. Sure. Thank you, Jeff.
And we'll be back here in a little bit. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio.